Okay, good afternoon. We're continuing on a more philosophical theme. Yesterday I tried to speak a little bit about miracles and kind of an emotional session because everybody has got a story which, you know, a lot of people wanted to share, which really was very, very moving. Today I want to talk a bit about mitzvot, the idea of commandments. It's something that, you know, if we're born into a religious home, it's something that we grow up with, even if we're not born in a religious home. When we went to Hebrew school, it's one of the first things that they teach you, is about observing or being aware of the fact that there is a series of biblical commandments which, as a Jew, one should be aware of and possibly, hopefully, try to be observant and, you know, sort of follow. And this is something which all of us are aware of. And it's kind of interesting because the word mitzvah, when it's used, usually in movies, in bad movies, do a mitzvah, you know, this sort of expression that you find, is not really what the word mitzvah really means. When you use the word in that context, it just means a good deed. Do me a mitzvah, tu me a mitzvah. And the answer is that, or the reality is the word mitzvah actually means a command. A commandment means it's an imperative, it's something that really one should feel one has to do. It's not just a good deed that, you know, if you choose to do it, but it's actually something that one feels one is bound to do. And in Judaism, we know that there are 613. That's the final number that is decided on. How that number is decided, I'm not even going to begin to explain to you because it's enormous discussion in many, many books. But 613 mitzvot. Commandments. What we have to really understand is what is the purpose of these mitzvot? Why do we have them? And more to the point, why are they such a backbone of Judaism? Why are they so important? It's so interesting. The Pirkei Avot, we all know this or we've heard it. Three pillars of the world, right? Torah, Avodah, Gemilut, Chasadim. That the world is based on three fundamentals. Study of Torah. The Avodah means the practice of service, usually referring to sacrifices in the temple. And Gemilut Chasadim, doing good deeds. Gemilut Chesed, Gemar. So the question, of course, is what happens when you have a clash between two of these pillars? For instance, if you're in a situation where you have to bring a korban, a sacrifice, or you have to do a good deed, you have to do a mitzvah, you have to help somebody, an act of tzedakah. The Gemara says quite categorically that an act of tzedakah supersedes, goes above and beyond, good afternoon, goes above and beyond even bringing a sacrifice. Kind of fascinating. I just want to quote that to you because it's just something that is worth knowing. It's Gemara Sukkah, and the Gemara Sukkah, page 49, and the Talmud says, "Omar Rabbi Loza, Godol ha'oseh tzedakah, greater is the one doing tzedakah, an act of charity, an act of tzedakah, yoseh mikorah kavonis, is greater than all of the sacrifices that one could bring." Very, very interesting idea that if you're in a situation where there's a clash between one of the three pillars of the world, between avodah, doing sacrifices, and gemilas chasadim, doing tzedakah, doing an act, a charitable act, then the charitable act is much, much greater. The idea, of course, what we're seeing here is that the charitable act represents a mitzvah, represents a commandment which we are commanded to do. And this supersedes everything else. The Gemara even says that it supersedes Torah. This is a quotation. Again, from the Talmud. Lo ha medrash ikka el ha-maisa. What is the main thing? It's not the medrash, the study, but it's the maisa, it's the action. And what we're actually going to say is that mitzvot, the idea of having commandments, obligations that we have to fulfill, is something which is really so, so central to everything that we are as Jews, to the point where it overrides, it supersedes everything. It goes over and above learning. If there's a choice between a mitzvah at a certain time and study, one goes to do the mitzvah. You have to stop the Beit Midrash. You have to go, for instance, if there's a Leviah, you have to accompany the dead person. It's an absolute commandment to do so. You've got a whole yeshiva running. The answer is the yeshiva stops. And they go and do this mitzvah. There are many, many examples of this. And the idea of the mitzvah is so central to us that we even go to the extreme of what is called hidu mitzvah. All right, hit a mitzvah. The idea, for instance, of beautifying the mitzvah. All right, I'll never forget the first time I bought an etrog in Israel. What you do in Eretz Yisrael, those who have been there for Sukkot, and you go and buy your lulav and etrog, is that the guy where you buy it from, there's so many hundreds of people selling, that you want to make sure it's kosher. So what I did, I was in Meir Shearim, and I bought this etrog, right, an estric. And the guy said to me, I said, I want to make sure it's kosher. So he said to me, well, you got to go and see Reb Mechel. Reb Mechel is the expert on estrogi. Who is Reb Mechel? I have no idea who this guy is. I said, how do I find Reb Mechel? He says, well, you go across the road, down the alley, because a lot of alleyways over there. And he says, you keep going and you ask for Reb Mechel. And everybody will know who he is. It's such a shtetl, it's not true. So I did this, and I go down the alleyway and find Reb Mechel after asking about three or four people. And there's a line of people outside his house. This is a Jerusalem rabbi, right, who is dressed in the whole gear, the whole works. And he is totally fed up with people knocking on his door showing him a slogan. He's just fed up with it. And when you show him, he almost throws it back at you. Kasha, he threw it back at me. And he said, get out of here. What are you doing here? You're wasting my time. And the only time he gets excited is when he sees one which is really beautiful. It's got the right shape and it's got the right bumps and, you know, color and everything else. And again, I'll never forget that. It's like a real experience going to try and find a Jew in the middle of Meir Shearim to check an estrog. It's an unforgettable experience. And I suppose there's people who do this in Borough Park as well. But the reality is that, no question, not only are mitzvot important, but to beautify the mitzvah, to have beautiful tefillin, to have a beautiful Shabbos table, to have everything that we can to make the mitzvah even more and more beautiful. That is a great, great thing. The real crunch of what we are going to get to today is the discussion about, really, again, a major difference between Judaism and other religions. Many other religions, when it comes to action and it comes to belief, they will say to you, there's no question about it, you've got to believe first. Belief is where it all begins. If you don't believe in you know who, then you're not a good whatever, Christian, Muslim, you know, you fill in the blanks. With Judaism, quite the opposite. Judaism says, and this is very strange to get your head around this, that belief is secondary. It's important to believe in God, but it's much more important to do mitzvahs. Much more important to do actions. And again, I'll tell you a story. We had a visitor in our shul. It must have been about 7 or 8 years ago. And there's a gentleman by the name of Rabbi Asher Wade. Asher Wade, some of you may know him. He is now Ger Chosid. He wears the whole works and a very tall hat and the whole thing. And when he introduces himself, you detect a bit of an accent. It's not an American accent. It sounds a bit like a German accent. So, you know, you're sitting there, you're wondering, very strange, who is this guy? And then he starts telling you his story. And it turns out that, in essence, what he used to be, what he started off life as, was a German pastor, a German minister. That's who he was. I'm not making this up, this guy is for real. And it says, and a pastor, like a vicar. And one day what happened is that he woke up one day and he decided that Christianity wasn't doing it for him. Right? He had questions about Holocaust, which, you know, a lot of Germans do struggle with, the ones who think about it. And at the same time, he also had questions about his own religion. He put it very bluntly. He says, I get up on a Sunday morning and I'm busy the whole day and I'm running to this service and to that service. You know, I'm a Christian minister, so I have to do this and do that. And it says, I get there, by the time I get to Sunday evening, I'm exhausted. But I wake up again on Monday morning, nothing. I may have somebody to see in a hospital, that will take me an hour. I may have to go and do a baby naming or a christening or whatever. But you know what? During the week, really nothing happening. Comes to Sunday again, and I'm meshuggah again. I'm crazy all over again. And he said, I was very dissatisfied with that. Even though he's a very conscientious Christian, he was at the time, he felt that his religion didn't do enough. It didn't do anything. And he was looking around for a religion that started to fulfill that need of doing something. And it says that he found it eventually in Judaism. And he started with reform, and he felt that that was lacking, and he worked his way through. And he's been in yeshiva for a number of years in Jerusalem, and he goes around the country, he goes around the world, telling this story. And you look at him, you just can't believe it. That this guy, once upon a time, was a Christian priest. Now, again, what is he saying? And one of the things he says very loud and clear is that the great, great benefit of being Jewish. And some people see this as a burden, right, in the Jewish world. But for him, it was such a bonus, was the fact that there is something to do every minute of the day. We heard that story about tying your shoelaces. All right. Even when you get out of bed in the morning, there's already something to worry about. Do you worry about washing your hands by the bed, or do you go to the sink to wash your hands? Which way do you sleep? Your bed's supposed to be in a certain direction. The halacha gives you instructions, right? And that's even before you've even got out of your bed, you're already worried about this. And the moda ani, when do you say it and how do you say it? Every single minute of the day. Right, you're looking already. Is it time for chakras? Is it time to learn this? Even working is a mitzvah. Okay, and working is a great mitzvah. The halacha talks about this, that derech eretz kodma l'tara, that by going to work, the rabbis would work and perform mitzvah after mitzvah by working. It says, I've forgotten the name of the rabbi in the Talmud. It says, but he used to be a blacksmith, so he used to hit the hammer. And a whole bunch of them, and this one he hit the hammer, and it says every time he hit the hammer on the nail, he would think of God, he would think of Yehudim, he would think of the essence of God while he was doing it. And this is what a Jew does the whole day. You're involved in mitzvot, you're doing action the whole time. And what is so incredible is that there's a statement in the Talmud, and again I just have to read it to you, and the Talmud is Talmud Yerushalmi. And it says, I mentioned this yesterday, the Talmud is quoting, paraphrasing the name of God, She'ilu oti azavu. God says that they can even forsake me. They can stop believing in God. V'torati shomaru, but they have to keep my Torah. They still have to perform the commandments. Meaning that even if they don't believe, even if they're really conflicted about their belief in God, the reality is they should keep commandments. And this, of course, reminds me of the very, very moving story, which many of you will know. It's a Holocaust story. It was made into a play by the BBC about 2 or 3 years ago. And it's a story of three rabbis who got together and they wanted to make a din Torah against God. They wanted to decide whether God was guilty for the events of the Shoah, of the Holocaust. And for 3 days and three nights, they deliberated, they made a din Torah, and they put God on trial. And at the end of the din Torah, it says they decided that God was guilty. They made a psak din, God is guilty. And what does that mean? What did that mean for them? In their circumstance, not very much, until one of them looked out of the window and he saw that the sun was going down. And he says, Rabosa, we've got a davar mincha. We haven't prayed yet. And you'll say to yourself, wait a minute, they've just found God guilty of probably the worst event in the history of the world, let alone of the Jewish people, and now they want to pray. They want to go and daven. It's time to pray. That is the Jewish mind. That even if you have these questions of belief and these questions of connection to God, it's time to daven. It's time to pray. It's time to bench. It's time to do this. It's time to do that. Everything in our lives is regimented around mitzvot. And that is something very unique and that is something very special. Other religions don't have that. Right, whatever they may say to you, they really do not have it. They don't have this constant interaction with commandments, with things that we have to do. The people I work with, I work in kashrus in Columbia University, and the kosher kitchen, I'm the only Jewish guy working in the whole kitchen, the mashgiach there, and it always amazes the people how these kids, a lot of from kids in the college, there's over 150 kids that use this kosher program every day, twice a day, some three times a day. And they can't believe the self-discipline of these kids. My colleague, my chef, who's a wonderful guy, he's at a camp, a kosher camp up the road here, for the summer, I go and visit him. And he always makes a joke with the kids. He sort of tries to suggest that he's put something not kosher in the food. And he wants to see their reaction. And immediately the reaction is, oh, we can't touch it. Go get the rabbi, quick. It's not as if he's kibbutzing. But he realized very early on that this is not a matter that you kibbutz around, right? For him, he realized that this is something where the discipline is so powerful, is so incredible. The action, the mindset of those guys, of those young people, that kosher is really the be-all and the end-all of what they're about, he just finds that so incredible. And everybody does. I mean, anyone who comes in contact with these young people, it's remarkable in the extreme. Because you see that is education in action. That these young people have been educated, they really do have this self-discipline. self-discipline. Kosher, for instance, is about self-discipline. Nobody's standing over you with a stick to say, don't eat this and don't eat that. We're brought up to do that. We're brought up to eat certain food and not eat other food. We're brought up to have a certain way of understanding there's a label on this food and not a label on that food. And sometimes we even have to question what label it is. What is the heksha? Is it the good one? Is it not so good? I get all these questions the whole time, and it's kind of complicated. But the reality is that we are about actions the whole time. There is a wonderful vort that I remember from my Rosh Hashiva. He says that there are two mitzvahs side by side in the Torah. One of them is a very strange mitzvah, the suspected adulteress, sota. The woman who's suspected of adultery. And what happens is that if we're not sure whether she's guilty or not, they do a test. And the test is that they take the name of God and they dissolve it, put on a piece of paper, dissolve it in water, and she drinks the water. If she was guilty, she dies. If she's not guilty, then she becomes fertile, so she can conceive. And it's a strange story. You know, it's one of those things that is not hasn't been practiced for many, many years. But what is so interesting is that the next chapter is about Nozir, the Nazirite, the guy who doesn't want to drink wine, and he decides he's not going to become impure with contact with a dead body. And the question is asked by all the rabbis, what's one thing got to do with the other? It's like two different worlds coming together in one chapter, or in two chapters, one chapter after the other. So I remember the Rosh Yeshiva, Reb Schwab, used to say like this, and he said it, and it's so true. He said that the idea is, if you witnessed the sota, and if you were standing there and saw this event, the woman drinking the water, and you either saw that she died in this horrible way, or you saw that she survived and everything turned around the way it did, then you would just be overwhelmed by what you were seeing. And he says that in Judaism, it's not about just seeing something, it's about doing. If you see an incredible thing, you've got to do something about it. You can't just sit there and be philosophically, what's the word, you know, sort of completely taken over by the event, and you start philosophizing about the greatness of God. Judaism is not into that. Judaism says you've got to do something. So what do? You take upon yourself an extra limitation. You take a chumrah, as they say. You become a bit more observant. And what is one way of doing it on a limited basis? Nozir. You become a Nazirite. You stop drinking wine for a month. Not a big deal. All right? So for Kiddush, somebody else makes Kiddush for you. And that sort of thing. But it's considered to be an action. And once you take an action and you do it, then what you've seen becomes part of your life. If you do an action based on what you've seen and what you've been inspired by, then that becomes permanent in your soul. If you just think about it, and you haven't actually done anything, it's not going to remain permanent. And that is, in essence, the one of the great clues to really to what Judaism and what our religion is about. It's about making those actions count. We'll go a stage further and we can ask the obvious question, what happens? Do actions bring belief? Or is it belief that brings actions? And A lot of what we do is obviously, hopefully, not only to do something, but to have belief, right? What I'm going to call the psychology of doing a mitzvah. But of course, the idea of belief is something very difficult, whereas an action is something we can relate to. Let me put it like this. What is an action about? Before you do anything, you've got to think about it. At least most people hopefully do think about it. Before you raise your hand, you know, you're thinking about doing something. You're thinking about when you get into your car, you're thinking about going to a certain place. So the action represents the thought process, the end of the thought process, which is doing something. That's what an action becomes. Becomes an end of a thought process. So what we're saying is like this, that a mitzvah, really, what is it really about? It's about the idea of doing something which is based on, hopefully, a feeling, a true feeling of connection to God. So in essence, the action formulates the belief. The action becomes the way that we can, using a strange word, actualize our belief. In other words, in my mind, I want to be closer to God, I want to understand God, and the Bible and the rabbis tell us the way to do it is through an action. You can have all of these great philosophical thoughts, you can have all of these great philosophical ideas, but if you don't do anything about it, it remains in your head. And who knows, sometimes you can be kidding yourself, self-deception. You know, human beings are very good at being holy in their minds, but not necessarily in their actions. And Judaism says, no, it's got to be about what you do, and not about what you think. Thinking is part of the process of doing, but not the end of the line. I want to say this because, again, as I said, we're going to get very philosophical today. It's something to think about, this whole purpose here. A lot of people question, what is the real purpose of the mitzvah? What is the real bottom line purpose of doing mitzvot? And you know something, the Rambam, who's such a great rationalist, he says that to try and understand the mind of God is beyond our understanding. And if we really want to get to the heart of what a mitzvah is about, if we're trying to understand God's reason for us doing it, it's never going to happen. Even Maimonides says that. On the other hand, the Rambam says, and he says something quite phenomenal, he says that we have an obligation to try and find a reason for a mitzvah whenever we can. I'll give you an example, and some of you may remember this, that it was always considered, certainly this goes back many, many years ago, before anyone here was born, there was a big debate about chazir, about eating pork products. And one of the big debates was about the negative harm that can come from eating pork. There's a certain disease, trichosis or trichinosis, where that... Trichosis, right? And this was always something which Jews never suffered from because they never ate pork, right? And that was the bottom line. And for many years, people argued, you know what? It could very well be why we have this mitzvah not to eat this thing. The reason is because you get sick if you eat it, if it's not treated properly. And this is something which, again, the Rambam does write about. Even though he says that for us to go into the deeper level of understanding God, we can't. But he says if we can try and find a reason which can satisfy us intellectually, we've got to do it. Because that helps us to do the mitzvah in a better way. There's a problem. A problem is that the reason goes away. What happens to the mitzvah? This is a very contentious issue and something which I raise, but I'm not going to sort of raise it in terms of halacha, but just as a comment. Today, what becomes people's major, major concerns once upon a time was something that, you know, was just above and beyond anything we would worry about. What do I mean? I'll couch this in a story. I visited about 9 months ago a restaurant in Wall Street. There was a new restaurant down there, something cafe, I forgot now what it was called. And what happened was that this restaurant was a remarkable operation. And it really was very needed in that area, you know, run by the Orthodox Union, the OU, very kosher place. And the only reason, in fact, it closed is because all of those demonstrations in Wall Street, people couldn't get to the restaurant. And eventually, they just couldn't cover their expenses, and it was a very big operation. I was sorry to hear about that. But one of the things in the restaurant that I asked them, I said, what do people come in and not like about this restaurant? You had fleishiks, you had milchiks, different sides of the restaurant. It was really a nice place, and the food was good, and I met the mashkia, very young, nice young man, who was very conscientious, and they had a whole team of people working there. What did people complain about? And they said to me, is there any one thing that they really do complain about? I couldn't believe it. He says, people come in here, and the first question they ask, not what is the heksha, and where does the meat come from, and all the things that one should ask, they want to know, is the milk Cholav Yisrael? Is it supervised? And that's the only question people ask. They were told no. They can't get Chol of Yisrael down in that part of they didn't insist on it. The OU doesn't, because the OU has their general brand of milk supervision. They rely on the general thing, the head to the allowance of Ramosha Feinstein, which has already been around for 50 years. And that's it. And people walk out. They don't stay. They don't even want to know. They don't even want to ask what's in the restaurant. No Chol of Yisrael, they're gone. And to me, it just blows my mind that this has become the standard of Jewish practice. This becomes something which everyone has, like, you know, adopted as being the be-all and end-all of Judaism. And it's a comment because it just really sort of says where a lot of people are at. And again, do they really think about mitzvot? What is Chol of Yisrael about? Chol of Yisrael, the whole issue 100 years ago, 50 years ago, was about mixture of milk. That you will get milk, sometimes it will be cow's milk, and to build it up, the farmer might put in pig's milk or some other milk. And therefore it was a problem. That's why you had to have a shomer, somebody to guard the milk. 50 years ago already, maybe longer, Moshe Feinstein was asked the question, and he said, nowadays the government supervision is very strong. If a farmer does that, he'll lose his license, he'll lose his parnasa. He's not going to put extra milk from another animal into cow's milk. It doesn't happen. And therefore, on the basis of that, and this is true to this very day, you can have regular milk. There's no issue. The reason for the whole thing has gone away. And nevertheless, there are so many people who seem, for whatever reason, to have adopted this as kind of the ultimate standard of kosher. And you know something? It really is, it's amazing. On the one hand, you can always argue, look, it fits what we're saying here, that even though the reason has not continued for having kosher milk, or having supervised milk, the reality is that it is something which was a standard which people want to observe. But again, you know, what we're saying over here is that we always look for reasons for observing commandments, and this is the danger, I would say, of having a commandment with a reason. Because as soon as the reason goes away, or as soon as we think we know the reason, and the reason no longer applies, then the mitzvah sometimes will fall by the wayside. And in some cases, that is justified. In other cases, like with milk, there's no real reason for worrying about the content of milk. Some people want to worry about it, fine. But the real reason has gone away. Other things where the reason might go away, like saying we don't eat chaza because of this worry about the disease doesn't exist anymore, it really doesn't happen. So therefore you'll say, does that mean you can now eat chaza? And the answer is no. The answer is absolutely not. So what I'm trying to say is that playing around with reasons and finding reasons is very helpful for us intellectually to keep the mitzvah the way it should be kept, but it's not the bottom line. The bottom line is that sometimes we have to just realize that the reason may not always be the bottom line of what we do. In other cases, the reason may very well dictate a certain logic towards what we do. And we've got to be very careful how we apply this whole concept of finding reasons. And in fact, let me quote you again. The Rambam is, Maimonides is a famous quotation. And I just want to read this to you because it's really something special. He says like this. He says, Ra'ui la'adam, it's fitting for a person, lehit bonem b'mishpatei Torah, to think about the laws of the Torah, leida sof in yanam kafi kocho, to understand them according to his ability, v'dava shela yimotze botam, but if there's anything where you can't find the reason, v'lo yeda lo ayalan, he has no reason for it, al yi kal be'inam, don't treat it lightly, lo yaros la lot al Hashem pen yifrotzbo, in other words, don't break the law because you just don't understand the reason. Don't treat it like a secular subject, where once the reason goes away, the whole thing disappears. And he gives an example about the law of Me'ilah, which is a special case, which he talks about. And he says basically, what his comment is that, yes, find reasons where you can. Kosher, a lot of people will tell you in the non-Jewish world, they buy kosher products because they feel they're more fresh or pure, a lot of this language. And long may they continue to buy them for that reason, because it gives the kosher market the extra boost that it needs. Great. But is that the reason that we who try to observe kosher should keep kosher? The answer is no, of course not. It can be maybe not as pure as we think it is, but kosher, the bottom line of it is that this is a commandment from God, what we call in Hebrew, Ratzon Hashem, the will of God, and we keep it because that's what we're told to do as Jews, period. And what I'm saying is, again, what bothers me today is that sometimes, you know, people have taken certain elements in the religion and exaggerated them and made them into something which maybe is beyond what they should be. As I explained with the Chol of Yisrael, that is a very, to me, it's something which I just don't understand. Why, of all things, one goes into a restaurant, that's the only thing that people seem to be particularly worried about. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. 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 Doesn't happen today, right? Right. And when what the question really is that when reasons are given, do they become critical in the whole discussion? It's interesting. Rabbi Shachter from Yeshiva University, the head of the Kola, my son asked him a question a few months ago about this whole thing of not eating fish and meat. Fish and meat is something that we are particular on Friday night. You have your gefilte fish, you take a schnapps or a drink, and then you have the meat to make a distinction. Sakona. And the Gemara calls it sakona, danger. And what is it? And again, at work, this is one thing that I find very difficult to explain to the chef, that he can't do, if he wants to do a lunch where he wants to offer a fish alternative, can't do it on the same grill as the meat. He's got to do it on a separate grill. And all of these types of things. And Rabbi Shechter was prepared to say that in our world, where these dangers are not as obvious to us as they were to the, in the Talmudic time, for whatever reason, who knows, he's not so, how should we say, adamant that this is a problem. Right? Meaning that if somebody eats fish and then straight away eats meat without an interruption, wouldn't eat them together, let's say, but he certainly would not be objecting to someone doing it one after the other without some sort of, you know, like a drink or whatever we do. But of course, you know, this is very interesting. There are certain things where clearly a reason has been given, and nowadays the reason doesn't seem to apply anymore. And the question then is, what happens to that particular observance, right? And as I said, the whole thing of Chol of Yisrael is a good example of this as well. As soon as the reason goes away, the government absolutely assures you that this milk is without any extra ingredients, then that reason for the whole idea of the milk has gone away. So this is one of the big grey areas in mitzvot, and then you get standards and different observances. Some people will continue this observance, some people say you don't. It's a problem. And this is something where one has to sort of, you know, ask a reputable rabbi and go by that decision. Don't shop around. Shopping around for rabbis is a very bad idea. There's a wonderful story that Bar Ilan, the computer program of question and answer, Shelot and Tshuvot, came out about 20 years ago. And apparently what they tried to do, and whether this is true or not, I don't know, but what they tried to do is to make it in such a way that they would codify all of the questions, all of the answers. And the way they did it was that they would gather answers from all around the world, even of modern questions, and you would type in your question, and then the next thing you would type in was the answer that you want, and then the next thing that the computer would tell you is which rabbi to ask. Right? If you think about it, that's an interesting program. Does it work? No. Really doesn't work. That's shopping around for rabbis. This one says it's allowed, this one says it's not allowed. Not a good way to go. If you follow a certain rabbi, follow that rabbi. Don't start looking for differences. And of course today, unfortunately, this is what goes on. I teach Bible, so of course I teach about Shlomo. Shlomo was someone who pushed the envelope. What did Shlomo do? He said, look, the reason for not having too many wives as a king, not having too much money, not having too many horses, he says that applies to a regular king. I'm Shlomo Melech, he said. I've got a great mind, a great intelligence. Doesn't apply to me. So what did he do? He had 1,000 wives, and he had, according to the Abarbanel, 40,000 horses. Who needs 40,000 horses, right? How do you feed 40,000 horses? And, you know, and all the money and the opulence and everything else. And what happened? His wives eventually caused his downfall. They brought in idolatry into Eretz Israel. The next thing you know, they're doing idolatry, and Shlomo's blamed for it. It says that he built the idol. He didn't build it. He allowed them to build it. But the reality is that, you know what? He's blamed for this. Even Shlomo, who played around with this idea of reasons for mitzvah, could not in the end succeed. He thought he was above the reason. And in the end, he was found out that the reason applies to him as much as it applies to anyone else. And it bugged him, because there was one mitzvah he could never find the reason for. And he thought he had the reason for everything. We know the mitzvah, the red heifer, right? The paraduma. He couldn't find the reason for it. And even Shlomo Melech has to say that this one is beyond my reason. And he had, and for Shlomo it's probably a good exercise. It was an exercise in humility. What is interesting is this concept, and it's something that people learn in Talmud. Greater is the one who is commanded than the one who is not commanded. God al mitzvah v'osa. Greater is the one commanded to do the mitzvah and he does it, than the one who's not commanded and he does it. So everyone asks the question, wait a minute, if I'm not commanded and do the mitzvah, I'm a volunteer. I volunteered to do a mitzvah, that's not a bad thing. I've done it voluntarily, I want to do it. Somebody who's commanded says, well, I have to do it, right? Why is the having to do it greater than the wanting to do it, the volunteer? And there are many, many answers given to this. And one of the great ideas, which I think is really to be understood here, is that when you volunteer to do a mitzvah, you're doing the mitzvah, judging it by your seichel. To you, it seems the right thing to do. So that's why you do the mitzvah. When you do the mitzvah because God has told you to do it, you're judging it by, if you want to call it that, God's seichel. And that is considered to be so much greater. It's unbelievable. That if you do something, you're commanded to do it, and you do it, much higher level of observance, and the rabbis talk about this, you're a greater person if you do what you're told to do. You follow the rule, you follow the script. If you come along and decide, well, I'll choose this one and I won't choose that one, and I volunteered to do this, but I'm not volunteering to do that, then that is not considered such a great person. And it's an interesting concept, again, an interesting idea. A question for all of us to think about is, how many mitzvahs of the 613, now that we've gone through a bit of the psychology and a bit of the background and asked ourselves, can we ever find a reason? We can try, but we shouldn't base our whole lives on reason. The really serious question is, how many of these mitzvahs do we actually have to keep? Really, how many mitzvahs should we have in our mind to keep? Should it be a few? Should it be as many as we possibly can? One argument is, half a loaf is better than none. Do at least what you can. The other argument is, if you have half a car, it doesn't run. All right, if I take out the engine, the car's not going to go anywhere. So I need to do really as much as I can. I love this idea which is brought in the Kabbalistic writing. And this probably answers the question from a Kabbalistic point of view. And the Bali Kabbalah, they say like this, when you do a mitzvah, you create a malach. You create an agent who is going to stand up on your behalf. When you do a negative act, an avera, you create a negative agent, a negative force. So the whole idea is that we should try and do as many mitzvot as we can to create as many positive agents on our behalf, not only for us, but for the whole world. We're told that the world is in balance. One mitzvah can tip the world into a positive balance. And that is something that we really need to think about when we are able to perform whatever mitzvah it is. What are we doing? What are we creating? Are we creating a good situation in this world? Hopefully, yes. Are we creating something incredible in another world that we're told, we're promised? I can't, again, like I said yesterday, I can't prove it to you, but this is one of the things that we're promised, that it really is the case. If we do a mitzvah, we're told a malach, an angel, is created. A positive force. Let's look at it like that. And of course, the whole idea, therefore, will be, as again, I think back to that story on Friday night, even something which is not really a mitzvah, tying your shoelaces, and the person sort of committed himself to doing that, in the end, that particular action created such a positive force, it saved his life. It's an unbelievable story, amazing story. And again, what are we going to say here? It's kind of tying all of this together. When we think about mitzvot, we think about what we are commanded to do, the idea would be to try and do as many as we can. This is again one of the great, great, very precious ideas in Jewish life. Rabbi Cook, the great first chief rabbi of Palestine, was asked by many, many right-wing sort of zealots of his day. I don't think Rav Zonnefeld asked him this question, but I think some of his followers asked him the question. Rav Cook, how can you support the builders of the new Yishuv in Eretz Yisrael, the new developments in Israel? The people doing it are irreligious. They are totally against observance. They just don't observe Sabbath, they don't observe festivals, nothing. How can you support them? How can you be, for want of a better word, a Zionist? And Rabbi Cook's answer was always the same answer. He says, you've got it wrong, gentlemen. He says, you don't understand that by doing what they're doing, they may not observe Shabbos, they may not observe kosher, but they're doing their mitzvah. Their mitzvah of building the land of Israel is a great mitzvah. Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is this week's parasha. And the fact is that by concentrating in that, they are becoming really very, very, enveloped in that mitzvah. And that is a great mitzvah. Don't look upon them as being negative in what they do. Look upon what they're doing as a positive mitzvah of developing the land of Israel. That's the way he saw it. He says, halavai, they would develop it and become a bit more religious in other ways. And he encouraged it. There's a famous story that he visited many kibbutzim with Rav Zonnefeld. They went together. And they went around, I think in 1915 or 19, no, after the war, must have been 1920, went to the Moshavim, all of the new settlements, to try and bring a bit of Yiddishkeit, a bit of Judaism, a sense of connection to those places which were not so connected, not so observant. There's a famous thing, there's a whole book about his trip. And Rav Cook was like that. Rav Cook was a person who saw the glass, as they say, half full of water. He didn't see it half empty. And when he saw a Jew performing something, a mitzvah in Israel, just by being in Israel, walking Dalad Amot, walking four steps as a mitzvah in Israel, as far as he was concerned, that was already the beginning of a process of that person getting closer to God. Didn't see it as a negative, he saw it as a positive. And halavai, halavai, there'd be more Jews like that in the world today, halavai. And that, I think, is something for us to think about. That even someone who is not observant, the Gemara says that every Jew is moli mitzvahs karima, is full of good deeds like a pomegranate. You count the seeds. Supposedly there are 613 seeds in every pomegranate. I'm reliably informed by one of my students many years ago who tried it and said it didn't work out. I said, okay, whatever it is, the idea is that, you know, it's one thing that the rabbis could relate to give you a kind of physical representation of what they're trying to say. They're trying to say that it's something like that, which has all of those seeds should represent, each seed should represent a good deed. And a good deed, this mitzvah, is a seed which grows into who knows what afterwards. That, I think, is what they're saying. Every Jew, they say, has mitzvahs kerimot, whether they're observant or not. The observant Jew is lucky because he or she may have more. But the one who's not observant, they still do good deeds. They still may give a tzedakah, they write a check. They may actually become, you know, join a synagogue every so often. They may, whatever they may do, they may have a bar mitzvah celebration. Whatever it may be, there's already a connection. And if that is the case, then the mitzvah is working its magic all over again. What I didn't say at the beginning is the root of the word mitzvah. This is what I want to finish with. Mitzvah is an interesting word. And somebody suggested that there's a Hebrew word which it's connected to, which is the word tsevet. Tzadi, vav, tav. Tsevet, mitzvah, is the same root. It means to connect. A tsevet in modern Hebrew means a team, a group of people. A team has got all different players, but they're all working to the same end. If we can understand that mitzvot connect Jews, connect us to God, and connect us to each other, then we have understood, in essence, what mitzvahs are really meant to be. This idea of bringing us closer to an infinite source. How can we really relate to God? God is above and beyond us. How do I know what God is? How do I relate to God? The way I can do it is through these actions. They may seem mundane. I open the door for somebody. I help somebody, you know, sort of do a chesed or whatever it may be. And I'm already getting closer to God. I'm taking my finite existence and turning it into an action which becomes infinite. It becomes precious. And I think this is something, as I said, it's a bit philosophical today. I make no apologies for that. But thinking about mitzvahs, what they are, the purpose, looking for reasons, understanding that the reason is not always going to be the bottom line of the mitzvah, but at the same time to appreciate that that's what we are about. We do things. We don't sit around and wait. We don't sit around and philosophize. We get up and do. Kum v'aseh, that's our motto. Get up and do it. And that is something which is so precious. I hope that maybe it's you know, take it away and ponder and think about this. It makes us very unique. It makes us very, very special. Any comments, please? Yeah. Yeah. One bundle. And that's the word mitzvah. Mitzvah means puts us all in the same connection. It's amazing. Any comments? Yes, Dr. Vision. Yeah. 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 Yeah, comes at the end. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. We have to work hard, and then we may get to, you know, sort of first base by the end of davening. If we could get to, you know, tears some ace at the end, who knows, you know, to understand, but at least we get to some beautiful. And that's the same idea. Exactly the same idea. It's very precious. Interestingly, some people also do a Seres Hadibros at the end as well. All right? In other words, that by the time you've gone through the davening, okay, you may argue you're coming now to maybe a deeper awareness of the very fundamental of Jewish life, what the mitzvah is, but you've got to go through this action of speaking, connecting, talking to God, whatever you want to describe it, before you start coming to the more philosophical thing, which is not everybody has you don't have an obligation to say it, right? But it's there in the siddur, it's there as making a message. It's very beautiful that. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I had an interesting question because a friend of mine, I was talking to him about this years ago, you know, how particular one should be about this. And he was told by his Rosh Hashiva in Israel that you do this once a day. Because everyone who does it all the time, you do it eventually, you don't think about it. Mitzvahs, one of the problems of being religious is that we do it, but we rarely put a thought behind what we're doing, because we're doing it by rote. So, you know, even when we put on the tefillin in the morning, it's a whole routine, which if you do after you're doing it 40, 50 years, you don't think about it. Kissing the mezuzah once a day in the morning and stopping just for a minute and thinking about it is more effective sometimes than doing this whole thing. I always like to watch the girls in college, because a lot of them, you know, they're kissing the mezuzah the whole time. If that works for you, fine. But what I'm saying is that, yeah, it is. And I think maybe it's one of those very precious things we can do to give us a bit more thought about what the mitzvah should really be. What is it about? What's in the mezuzah? The Shema, that God guards our homes, but you know, we hope and everything to do and guarding our lives as well. Yes, please. Yeah. And put into Seret Dibur, Sajagon, he tried to do that. Yeah. They tried to do that. There's a lot to say about the Ten Commandments, but that's for another discussion. Because what happened to it? It's evolved over the years. I just hope and pray. Let's just leave it with a tefillah for all of us. That, you know, as we say, we should always be meriting, always have the merit to do more and more mitzvot in our lives. Because this is really what it's about. Yeah, let's try and philosophize and come closer to God and think about that. But doing the mitzvah is really what it really is about. In essence, our whole life should revolve around mitzvahs, and you know, that's I hope a wish for everybody. Have a good day, everybody. Thank you very much. Thank you.